This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ogi Ogas. He is the author of a very interesting book. It's called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. Ogi, it's great having you on.
Thanks for having me.
So just to go over some of your background information, you received a PhD in computational neuroscience from Boston University, where you designed mathematical models dealing with learning, memory, and vision. And can you explain to our audience what exactly is computational neuroscience and how it relates to the issues and research that you deal with in your book?
So computational neuroscience is basically treating the brain like a big computer, and you're trying to decode the software of the brain. So for vision and memory, you're just trying to figure out how the brain processes vision and memory as if it was using a computer program. So it's got a lot of the same techniques that you use in programming, for example. And that informed the way that we tried to understand the sexual brain. But to be honest, since so little is known about the sexual brain, that we really couldn't get very far in terms of decoding the software of the sexual brain. We had a few models, but it's all pretty new and basic research.
So your book, A Billion Wicked Thoughts, basically it analyzes human sexual desire, and there really hasn't been such an extensive study on human sexuality like this since basically the Kinsey study.
That's right. It's rather surprising that is the case, that the truth is there's been very little systematic analysis of what really turns men and women on. Most of the research that's been done on people's sexual interests and sexual preferences has been self-report surveys, where you just ask people what they like. And in fact, that's what Kinsey himself did way back in the 1950s. But it hasn't really been possible to kind of objectively figure out what it is that men and women are interested in until the internet came along. And so we were the first research to just go into new online data and just grab huge amounts of online data about people's sexual behaviors online and take all that data and try to figure out the patterns of sexual behavior.
So basically, would you say you view the human mind basically as a software?
Yeah, that's a bit of a simplification, but it's not a bad simplification. I'd say like the mind's like a computer, and maybe the mind is the software running on the hardware of the brain.
So one of the major things you cover in your book is basically you say that men and women, their brains are wired differently biologically, and that basically affects their sexual desires. How well known is that? I think it's not, I think a lot of people talk about that, but it's not always politically correct to say that.
Yeah, I mean, so the basis for most of our conclusions is mostly coming from our online data. So we certainly know very limited research that's been done on the sexual brains themselves. Most of our understanding of the sexual brain is actually from other animals. It's from rats and from primates. Very little research done directly on the sexual brains in people, but we know a little bit. And but what was really useful was to actually see human behavior on a very large scale on the webs. So, for example, we were looking at people's behavior not just in the United States, but all around the world. In China and India and Japan, in Africa, South America. So we were looking at the behavior not just of a few thousand people, but literally hundreds of millions of people. And you see very, very clear differences between what men and women do online. In fact, really, men and women's sexual behavior online couldn't be much more different. Just the patterns, the interests, the way men and women approach sexual content online, the time they spend on it, men and women are different on just about everything.
So in your research, you basically use internet searches, AOL searches, analysis of erotic story, tags on video sites, I guess sites like Pornhub, online personal ads, internet dating advertisements.
That's right, and credit card purchases. We used the traffic to different websites. We used, like you said, AOL search histories, and then we used anonymous searches as well. We also, what else? Like we analyzed digital romance novels, about 20,000, I think, altogether. Digital romance novels. I mean, some of them are digital erotic novels as well, and a lot of fan fiction stories, which is a particular kind of erotic story. It's sort of a very special class, I guess you could say. It's not necessarily always erotic, but we looked at over a million fan fiction stories as well. So, really, just many, many different kinds of online data. We also looked at a few specialty websites. For example, there's one website where people make custom requests for sexual content. So it's mostly men who get on and they specify, you know, I want somebody to, you know, I want a heavy woman with red hair to say my name while she smokes a cigarette and takes off her clothes, you know, very, very specific. And that site, you know, shared their data with what people were requesting. Webcam sites. We did some analysis on webcamming too. So just really all kinds of different online data. A lot of people think we just looked at searches. We went way, way, way beyond that.
And this was all anonymous because I know there's obviously going to be a lot of privacy concerns about that. People feel uncomfortable with the idea of their most personal private desires being stored in a database. So this was all anonymous.
So we certainly have no knowledge or access to people's identities. We didn't get any data ourselves that allowed us to look at that, and we certainly didn't seek that out. That wouldn't have been helpful to us anyway. But it's the case that, you know, if you go online and look at stuff and download stuff and click on stuff, you're leaving a record, and you know it's always going to be possible for somebody to figure that out. So our data, we didn't get that, but it was pretty clear from our research, too, that, my gosh, you know, we're all leaving these trails, and it's not hard at all if somebody's motivated to figure all this stuff out about ourselves.
I know when Kinsey did his work, there was issues with censorship and political barriers. Have you dealt with the problems of censorship yourself?
Well, it's really interesting because before we published the book, we were well aware of Kinsey. Went back in the 1940s and 50s. Now, religious conservatives and other cultural conservatives had a very negative reaction to his research and eventually managed to stop his research and caused him all kinds of problems later in his life. And wanted to censor his books and censor his research, and they did manage to stop the funding of his research. Now, that was a long time ago. But since then, still, even today, some cultural conservatives and social conservatives out there definitely aren't very interested in sexual research. So before we published the book, we were fully expecting there to perhaps be some backlash from the conservative end. But to our surprise, we never had any problems at all with social conservatives. They never took much of an interest in our work at all. But we had much stronger pushback, surprisingly, from the left, from more progressive and liberal culture reactionaries who didn't like the fact that we emphasized how different men and women's sexual behaviors and sexual tastes were. So in today's society, it was rather interesting that that seemed to be more provocative and generate, you know, a greater cultural reaction than social conservative side. Definitely, we got plenty of messages and plenty of pushback, especially at first from people who thought that we were overemphasizing the, you know, differences between men and women.
You're saying the idea that men and women, their brains are wired fundamentally differently. It's not always politically correct to say that.
That's right, and they didn't like the implications of that. And you know, all we can say is just look at the data. The data is just absolutely overwhelming. I mean, to be honest, before I started the research, I expected there to be less differences between men and women. I knew the neuroscience data, and I knew there were some differences, but I thought, you know, probably men and women weren't going to be that different. But you know, I came around, you know, the data, once we started looking at it, it's not ambiguous at all. I mean, it's just night and day between what men are doing and women are doing.
So basically, men and women have different sexual cues. Men are much more visual, and women, their sexual cues are more psychological.
Yeah, if you had to boil it down, that's a pretty convenient way to do it. There's a little more nuance than that, but that's, you know, if you wanted to do it, break it into something really simple, that would be pretty accurate. And along with that, one other complementary finding to the fact that men and women are so very different is the fact that gay men and straight men are almost identical. Really, there's not much difference at all, if any, between the behaviors of gay men and straight men, except that gay men are preferring to look at men and straight men are preferring to look at women. But in every other respect, gay guys and straight guys are exactly the same. And they're, you know, both gay and straight guys are completely different from lesbian and straight women. Lesbian women and straight women also, you know, very, very similar behaviors. And those behaviors are quite different from gay and straight men.
And the other thing you found in your study is that there's physical arousal and psychological arousal. So with men, psychological arousal tends to coincide with physical arousal, but with women, it's not always necessarily the case.
Now, that's one of the most fascinating biological differences and psychological differences between men and women. And this has been now shown in a number of studies. There was one classic study that showed it first, where what they did was they showed a group of men, a group of women, different sexual imagery. So they showed them a heterosexual couple having sex. They showed, you know, gay men having sex, lesbian women having sex, and animals having sex. So a bunch of different kinds of erotic content. And they measured the subjects, both their physical arousal using there's a special device that tests how erect a man becomes, and there's a special device to tell.
You actually used the plethysmograph in your work.
That's right. Exactly right. And in women, that, you know, measures both the temperature and the tightness. They also asked them for psychological feedback. How turned on, you know, self-report, how turned on did you feel? And what was fascinating was with the men, it was really straightforward. If a man was physically aroused, he was psychologically aroused too. And men were only aroused by one particular thing. So if it was a straight guy, he was aroused by the women or the heterosexual couples. If it was a gay guy, he was only aroused by gay men. There was not any overlap with the other content. But with women, it was really fascinating. Women said they were only psychologically aroused. They only felt aroused by the expected content. So if it was a straight woman, she said she was aroused by watching, you know, a heterosexual couple. But women's bodies were aroused by everything, even including watching animals have sex. So there was definitely this complete separation in between you know, women's bodies getting aroused and women's minds getting aroused that you didn't find in men. And this has been replicated, you know, many times, and there are now even some brain studies that kind of show these differences in men and women's brains too. That research is really rudimentary, though, so that's not the neural research is pretty rudimentary, but you know, it seems very, very clear that this is just a fundamental distinction. And you can, you know, you can think of an evolutionary explanation why that might be. You know, it's in a man's interest from an evolutionary point of view, from an animalistic point of view, to have as many offspring as possible with as many women as possible. So if he has any opportunity to have sex, his body should, you know, be ready and willing to have sex, and his mind should be too. But for a woman, having sex is a much bigger commitment of resources. You know, she's pregnant, of course, for 9 months, and she needs more food, she needs more shelter, she needs more protection during the time, and then the whole process of child raising requires an enormous amount of resources. So for a woman, it only makes sense to have a child if she's in an environment where she's safe and secure, and preferably there's a man there protecting her and also helping to raise a child. So therefore, it doesn't make sense for a woman to have sex with absolutely every guy that she is attracted to. So it would make sense that her mind is somewhat separated from her body on that, so that she can make a rational, or at least some kind of thoughtful emotional decision before she has sex. So that seems a reasonable evolutionary explanation. Of course, there's no way to know for sure if that's how this came to be. All we know for sure is that this difference is very real.
And the other difference between men and women is, since men are primarily visual, but they don't care so much what other men think. They see a girl and they decide that they like her based on how they look. Women care a lot more what other women think. Do you have findings? So your findings back that up.
Yeah, when you look at even just the way that men and women behave online with regard to erotic content, women enjoy discussing erotic content. They enjoy discussing erotic stories, or they enjoy discussing celebrities on some of these erotic sites too, and they share opinions. And it's clear that these opinions matter and have an effect on women's opinions of things. You know, in contrast with the men rarely talk about their sexual interests and sexual, when they're looking at erotic content, what they find arousing. They rarely discuss that with other men. And when they do, it's very, you know, brief and crude and to the point, and not really much of, oh, let me hear about your thoughts and let me think about those thoughts. It's pretty blunt and straightforward when it does occur, which is not very often.
And are there any unusual fetishes that you were surprised that a large number of women were interested in?
Women are not very fetish-oriented, and they do not have – there's definitely no sizable, unusual sexual behavior in women. Now, of course, that depends on your definition of unusual. Women are very interested in themes of domination and submission. This is one sexual interest that we all have in common, the only sexual interest everyone has in common, men and women, gay and straight, is domination and submission themes. That was a big surprise. But women are just as interested in domination and submission themes as men. So women's
erotic
stories.
You're saying both dominating and being dominated.
Right, right. You know, you can't really have somebody dominating without somebody else being dominated. So those always go hand in hand. And women tend to prefer erotica where there's a very dominant, strong man and often a submissive woman. There's definitely variations on it, but you'll find everything from, you know, hardcore rape in women's erotica to more gentle romantic relationship where the man's still strong and dominant. And another, if there's any, perhaps you're asking if there's any unusual fetishes. This isn't a fetish, but maybe something that was a bit of a surprise was the popularity of erotic stories for women featuring two men, so men having love and men having sex. And often they're depicted as heterosexual men. You might say, well, if they're heterosexual, why are they having sex? Like that's part of the female fantasy. It's having two strong masculine men having sex. But usually in those stories, one man is the dominant one and one is the submissive one. And there's a lot of reasons probably why this kind of erotic is popular with women. But back to the domination submission theme, one reason might be that it also allows women to enjoy the domination and submission theme without there being a female victim. A lot of women, you know, are understandably very uncomfortable reading about a situation where a woman's being, you know, sexually dominated by a man. It can be arousing, it can be scary, it can be both of these, but if it's two men, it takes away for a lot of women that sense that there's a female victim there. So if I was going to point to anything that was surprising in terms of its popularity, it's probably male-on-male erotic fiction for women. But really, it's the guys that have all the strange stuff, not the women.
You found that women hate facial ejaculation.
Yeah, well, that's a common finding. You know, we didn't find anything different, but a lot of different surveys have looked into that. But you know, one of the interesting data sets on that came from a website called Shush.com, which is the oldest website which features erotica, oldest paid website with erotica for women. There's not many profitable websites featuring erotica for women, and this is one of the very few ones. And at one point, they did a really extensive survey of all of their members, like because they create custom erotic videos for their members on the site, and they were like, "What do you guys want to see?" And they had a very extensive survey, and they ranked all the different possibilities. You know, do you want to see woman on top, woman on bottom? You know, two women, three women, two guys, what would you like to see? And at the absolute bottom of the list that women rated the thing they least want to see, it was a facial ejaculation. So that was, on a website where people have signed up, where women have signed up and they're paying money to look at visual erotica. And in that group, the thing they least wanted to see was facial ejaculation. So that's a pretty strong statement.
One of the misconceptions, this is about homosexual men, is that there's a lot of people have a preconceived misconception that basically homosexual men are women's minds stuck in men's bodies.
Yeah, at least sexually, that's not true. Gay men are just as diverse in their personalities as straight men are. So, but when it comes to sex, gay men they like it visual, they like anatomy. They like domination and submission themes. They like it. They like young partners. Basically, if you put the list of the top straight guy interests next to the top gay guy interests, they map onto each other. Really, really closely. Youth is the top for each of them. There is a strong interest in overweight women. They're often called BBWs, big beautiful women. And there's a strong interest in bears among gay men, which are, large, big, usually hairy men, but they're always big, kind of overweight guys. And another interesting parallel is there's a lot of different varieties for straight men of porn with men dominating women, like drunk porn, hypnosis porn, sleep porn, groping on the subway porn, where guys are taking advantage of are tricking women. Bang Bus, where is a famous one where they pick up girls, and for the girls to get a ride, they have to, perform sexual acts or have sex with the guys in the van. And what's interesting is among gay men, there's equally popular pornography that features dominating and tricking straight guys. So where a straight guy is tricked into having gay sex, or a straight guy, in order to earn money, has gay sex, or there's Bang Bus. It's a bait bus where they trick straight guys into a van and they think they're going to have sex with girls, and it ends up being a guy. They use girls to lure a straight guy into the van and put a blindfold on them, and then he thinks it's a woman performing fellatio on him, and turns out to be a man. So gay guys are just as interested, exploitation and tricking porn. It's just they like to see it happen to straight guys, whereas straight guys like to see it happen to women.
And with gay men, is the fantasy more about them wanting to dominate heterosexual men, or do they have a fantasy about being dominated by a heterosexual man?
I think they have both. I mean, I think a lot of gay men, especially gay men who are what we call bottoms, who prefer to be on the bottom, there, there's some politics associated with that, but we looked at 1.8 million men seeking men ads on Craigslist, and almost exactly two-thirds of them were bottom seeking tops, and one-third were top seeking bottoms. So most gay men are bottoms, and most bottoms would say, yeah, they would like a straight guy to take them. But and in most just straight up gay porn, the straight acting guy, if one porn actor is straight acting, straight seeming, he's usually the top. But there's also a lot of porn where straight guys get tricked into having sex. And sometimes in that porn, though, the straight guys just get tricked into or get paid money to let the gay guys do things, you know, do things to them. So it's really kind of the straight guys are still kind of in the dominant role. It's just they're agreeing to let gay guys do things to them for money or for books or for a ride or whatever. One other really sharp contrast is if you look at gay erotic stories, so, you know, erotic stories written by gay men for gay men, and compare that to women's erotica, you know, erotic stories written by women for women, absolutely different. You know, there's no mistaking one for the other. You know, erotic stories written by gay men, it just it jumps right into sex, and it's like all sex, it's very graphic and visual from start to finish. When it's written by women, it's always psychological. There's always analysis of what's going on in the different characters' heads. You know, it might take a long while before there's any actual physical sex because there's a lot of mental and psychological buildup. Just a completely different world. There's no mistaking, you know, a gay sexual brain for a female sexual, a straight woman's sexual brain.
And another thing is that's surprising is that a lot of straight men are like enjoy looking at penises and also basically tranny porn or looking at pictures of other guys' penises.
So that's a complicated thing, but not too hard to explain. So it was a big surprise at first when we looked at how often straight guys are searching for penises and how prominently penises are featured in pornography. But actually look at this, it becomes pretty clear what's going on. In all of the porn that features, you know, penises, especially large penises, which is what most guys are looking for, you rarely see the large penis without the woman's face near it. And so there's always, it's always showing the penis with a female reaction. So a woman's looking at the giant penis or the penis and being scared or shocked or delighted or surprised or happy or amazed or anxious or whatever the case may be, there's always a really strong, clear emotional reaction on the woman's face. So it's kind of the pairing of the man's penis with the woman's reaction that seems to be what guys are looking for. So it isn't that guys are just looking at, you know, disembodied pictures of penises without anything else going on. It's almost always pictures of penises, you know, with a woman reacting. If it's a video, you know, the woman will spend time talking about the penis and reacting to it. But nevertheless, it is interesting that that is a very prominent feature of men's pornography. It's not something that had ever been reported in the academic literature before and, you know, that nobody had really talked about. But it's really there's a really interesting parallel. I give a talk about this to academic conferences, and I have some slides that I show that shows in primates, so like monkeys and chimpanzees and bonobos and gorillas, among all of our primate cousins, the penis is a really prominent social tool that's used to mark territory, to indicate aggression, to indicate sexual interest, of course, to indicate social dominance. It's used for a lot of things, and male primates are always examining one another's penises because if it's erect, it, you know, means this. If it's they display their penises and so they're looking for displays. So among all of our primate cousins, the males pay close attention to other males' penises and what's going on around them. So it's probably not a surprise that we probably, human men, still have some vestigial or maybe not so vestigial circuitry that's still compelling us to do the same thing. We also observed that if you go on, when we did our research, there was a website called Chat Roulette, and since then there's other similar sites too. There's just an astonishing number of men that just have a webcam trained on their penis. So there seems to be this overwhelming urge just to show your penis as well as look at it. And
kind of like the Anthony Weiner case.
There you go. Like and Brett Favre. I mean, there's at least a dozen. Kanye West did it. There's at least a dozen celebrities that have you know, been caught doing this. Anthony Weiner is the most famous and hilarious.
So you're implying that public people who engage in indecent exposure, exposing themselves in public, are engaging in natural behavior.
I think so. Honestly, I think I don't think they're raised the wrong way. I don't think it's something. I don't think there's something wrong with them, other than maybe a lack of self-control. But I think the impulse itself. I think the impulse itself is probably something wired into us. I mean, the chimpanzees do it; they're our closest relatives, and it's just so prevalent and common and consistent among humans that it just seems to be something we inherited from our ancestors. And you know, civilization kind of makes us put that away. But it's like sneezing; it's just something you. It's just an impulse. I mean, of course, with sneezes, we all learn to cover our mouth when we sneeze, you know, so, you know, I'm not saying, if a guy's, you know, showing his junk around, he shouldn't be forgiven, and, you know, in some cases it's a crime, so I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying I don't think the basis of that is some, you know, demented sensibility. I think it just might be just something that's rooted in our and deep in our sexual brains.
Prevalent and common is the theme of a straight men being dominated by a women?
So
that
like
the dominatrix thing.
Yeah, that was more common than we expected, and it's definitely one of the most common sexual interests among a straight man. I mentioned that pornography that features the man being dominant is extremely variable and creative. It's extremely creative. You know, there's porn where girls are getting drugged, porn where girls are tricked in a pawn shop, porn where girls are tricked, you know, they think they're being cast for a movie and they end up, you know, having porn. Just such a wide variety of variations of that. Same for men being submissive. There's just all kinds of different variations of men being dominated by women or men being forced into unusual situations. One, you know, one particular kind is kind of interesting. It's called CFNM, which stands for clothed female, naked male, or naked man. And it usually features a naked man and usually women in clothes who are mocking him and laughing at him. It's one of the few kinds of...
Do they make fun of his penis size?
Yes. So I was about to say, it's one of the few kinds of pornography that often features small penises, and it often features women laughing, taunting the man. Sometimes in the porn, the man has a normal or a large penis, but you know, it often features embarrassing situations like in a classroom at school where all the girls in class or the teachers laughing at the guy or having an angry face, or it can be like at a business conference, you know, it's all these women in suits, what looks like a conference, and the man's up there as if he's giving a presentation, but for some reason he's completely naked and suddenly embarrassed. So clearly it's very creative, and it taps in, I guess, to some sexual interest in being submissive. So that's one of the more interesting kinds, but a lot of it's just straight up, like, you know, you'll find, you know, women forcing a man to, you know, lick her boots or to service her or even to, you know, perform fellatio on another man, you know, or, you know, there's a huge variety of pornography featuring cheating wives or cheating girlfriends where a man's wife is having sex with another man, and some of the more extreme versions that really emphasize the man's submissiveness. The husband might not just be watched. He might have to, you know, pleasure the man while he has sex with the wife, or even, clean up the wife afterwards. So different things like that. So all kinds of variations where the man's being submissive and very popular, much more popular than certainly we expected it to be.
And also there's the theme of age. What is more common? Like there's, on one hand, you have the MILF thing, and then you have the interest in youth. I mean, straight men, there's barely legal porn, and then homosexual men have the twink thing. What's more, as far as the age issue, what is more popular?
So definitely, all men like it young. I mean, it's a great truth. No real surprise there. Perhaps the only surprise was just how amazingly popular youth is in pornography for men all around the world, every country. It's always the number one interest by a wide margin is porn featuring. You know, teens is the usual way. And, you know, a little bit scary, but there's a huge amount of searches for, women under the legal age, under age 18. You know, some parts of the world that is still legal, you can go to 16, 15. I think in Japan it's 14 maybe. I know it's pretty young there, but a huge amount of interest in youth among both straight men and gay men, like you said, by a wide margin. So, but there's also what we found surprising is a huge interest in MILFs, which of course stands for mother I'd like to fornicate with. And usually women in the 30s or early 40s, very popular, also in every world, very consistent interest in women in that age range. And it's interesting because interest in women, who are a bit older, it's a particular kind of women. It's you might think that it's, there's a very big variety, but actually it's usually women who are aggressive, who are dominant, who are confident, in control, who are the seducers. It's usually MILF porn features a MILF who's seducing, a younger man who takes control. So that seems to be part of that interest. But enormous, one of the most popular, definitely a top 10 interest for men all around the world. And then what really surprised us was the level of sexual interest in much older women, women in their 50s, in their 60s. It's often called granny porn, and this was also consistent all around the world with interest in older women. Now, certainly much smaller than an interest in MILFs, an interest in MILFs, one of the top 10 interests for men. Granny porn not up there, but also not one of the rare ones. There's a lot of other pornography that we're all familiar with that's a lot rarer than the interest in granny porn. So, and you might think, oh, they're probably looking for over-the-top stuff, probably humiliating grannies or really strange stuff. Actually, granny porn is the most, tame and straightforward kind of pornography. It's just women of a certain age, having completely normal sex acts. There's nothing, most of it is completely vanilla stuff, and that seems to be what people are after. They're just turned on by the fact that it's an older woman, so... that's a big surprise, and nobody's got a good explanation. Certainly, evolutionary theorists don't have a good explanation for it. It doesn't really fit cultural theory either, because, cultural theorists would suggest that we're getting reinforced. Society is telling us that this is something we should be attracted to, and society is definitely not doing that. So it's a real puzzle. We have a couple ideas about it, but definitely it's a real unsolved puzzle why this is so popular.
With the research doing with men who are looking for girls who are under the age of 18, did you encounter like any legal barriers in your research?
So we definitely went out of our way to make sure we weren't accessing any of that content. We were looking at people's searches or attempts to see it. So we didn't ever look at what they might have ended up with.
Are the searches inherently illegal by themselves?
I mean, you can enter whatever you want in a search engine. You're not going to get arrested for entering, I want to see a hot, 13-year-old in your search engine. But if something comes up and you click on it, you might get a visit from the FBI. I mean, it's not that easy. Even though we definitely didn't access it, we do know from our experiences and from talking to plenty of people in the industry and from this, it's actually, pretty difficult. You can't just enter show me 13-year-old sex and find, a huge list of content. You have to go out, you have to really work to find it. So, even given the fact that it's illegal and that it's easy to get caught, boy, just an enormous amount of searches for underage women. Now, let me say, most of the searches for underage women, it searches for women, for girls that are 14, 15, 16 years old. So, you know, a lot of people might not consider that child pornography, searching for, you know, for erotic content with a 15 or 16 year old. But even having said that, there are definitely people searching for erotic, large numbers of people searching for erotic content, you know, of females under the age of 12, even, for example.
Well, there's the theme of legal porn where the girls are 18, but they look much younger.
Yeah, that's extremely popular, you know, where barely legal or where they're picked to look younger than 18. Very, very popular. In fact, I don't talk about this in the book, but we had the good fortune of doing our research at a really interesting tipping point in the online pornography, in the business model of online pornography. So in the early years of the Internet, the business model for online porn was a subscription model where to access porn, you pay a website a certain amount of money per month, and you get access to everything on that website. And under that model, you have websites that were devoted to very particular sexual interests, very particular fetishes. You know, you might have a website that was just devoted to, you know, overweight Asian women. Or I remember one website, just because it was one of the very first ones we did research on, was Fart Fantasy. So it was a website devoted to guys that were aroused by girls farting in their face. So very, very narrow and specific. And you'd pay a monthly fee. I think the fee for that site was $30 a month, and you got a month's worth of access to all the, you know, girls farting guys you could handle. But then after YouTube became popular, there became the rise of what are known as the tube sites, which were YouTube knockoffs for pornography. Now, nowadays, of course, this is, we're all familiar with Pornhub and Xvideos and RedTube and Xhamster. There's a few giant tube sites. But when we did our research, the first tube sites were really just becoming popular for the first time. But there was still almost all of the subscription sites. So we had access to, you know, all these subscription sites, which allow us to see the popularity of different fetishes. You know, we could see, you know, what's the traffic to Fart Fantasy compared to the traffic for granny porn. You know, it allowed a really clear comparison. And we could also see the number of purchases, you know, for each site too. And that was, you know, really helpful. Now, though, when we're doing our research and we were interviewing different webmasters, porn webmasters, they all were, you know, bemoaning the arrival of these tube sites and saying it was going to spell the end of online porn. And they're right that it spelled the end of the subscription model. The subscription model has almost completely vanished, and, you know, it's almost all tube sites. But one of the few kinds of subscription sites that have managed to survive into the tube era are teen and barely teen sites. There's still a few sites, you know, featuring especially busty teens, but sites featuring teens, there's still a number of subscription sites that have managed to remain profitable. Just about every subscription site's gone away, but if you can show very young-looking women and can prove that they're 18, then you're still going to manage to pull in, you know, a large number of guys, certainly enough to make.
You can probably see the same with gay porn too.
Exactly right. Exactly the same thing. The few subscription sites have survived. I know there's still some like broke straight guys is still around, and yeah, a few of them. and sites for young guys too. So very similar thing. They almost all went away, but the really popular ones have managed to stay. If you can show young guys or young girls and have the papers to prove they're legal, then you can still make it a nickel and a dime in online porn.
I heard this story. I think it was from one of your interviews. I think it was from your book, but there was actually a construction worker who was just he was a normal guy, and he got injured, and he basically became a pedophile from a head injury. Did you that story from your book?
That's really controversial. I haven't seen any evidence that it's so clear cut. I know there's been claims like that, and there's been some papers on it, but there's always been some uncertainty about it. I don't have a strong opinion on it. I'm dubious. I'm very skeptical of it. It's hard to see how that would make sense. If I had to guess, and this is pure speculation, it would be that the head injury reduced some kind of inhibition or self-control in general. And, you know, clearly the evidence suggests that, you know, a majority of men are interested in young women and, you know, don't draw the line at 18. And so perhaps the head injury just, he lost some inhibition in general. And so an interest that was always there that maybe he just was able to resist, he just could no longer resist. I suspect it was something more along those lines than, you know, he used to be interested in adult women, and then after the head injury, he became interested in younger women. That seems a little more far-fetched to me, but you know, I'd have to see the research.
So with the issue of sexual hang-ups, like some people are opposed to homosexuality. Some people are, say, opposed to interracial sex. Do you think there's a biological reason for that? A lot of people would say those people are just ignorant and they need to be educated, or do you think some people might be biologically wired to dislike homosexuality?
So I think we all are wired, but let me. You know, it's easy to misunderstand this, so let me break it down. So it's not that we're wired to be anti-gay, and it's not that we're wired to be anti- sex between the races. We are wired, men in particular, are wired at an early age in puberty that we kind of imprint on what is considered to ourselves sexually normal and sexually appealing, and then we find anything outside of that to be unappealing. So we are wired to have very narrow sexual interests. That's why men develop fetishes so easily and develop fetishes on such a wide variety of different things, and women don't. It's because the male sexual brain, and it's not just, you know, human males. You find this in males in a lot of species, and females in some other species. It's that there's this critical period where what we consider to be, you know, sexually right, it gets imprinted, it gets stuck, and then we stay with that for life for the guy's brain. So I think because of that mechanism, whatever we find to be sexually attractive, everything else seems sexually unappealing. And this isn't just limited to homosexuality, though that's a particularly strong feelings about that, of course. But often if you look at pornography that turns other people on, like our fantasy, for example, like most men have a very negative reaction, and the reaction is that's something, you know, weird and strange and, you know, wrong. And it's that the reason we have those feelings is because of this imprinting mechanism, that we have the kinds of things that we consider to be, you know, right, and everything else is wrong. So it's a very general mechanism. It just gets applied to homosexuality, because homosexuality, unlike a lot of these other things, isn't just a sexual act. You know, it's a relationship. It's visible. It's visible and has components outside of pure sexuality. So it forces us to confront it in a way that we don't, you know, like far fantasy, you don't know if you're looking at a man that enjoys, that is aroused by women's farts. But I bet if that was turned into a lifestyle, then that would have the same kind of passions against it as you would find against homosexuality. So I do think there's a biological basis for this aversion to it. It's just not anything particular to homosexuality.
So overall, would you say that sexual interest is more biological than it is cultural influences?
For men, it is. For women, it's the opposite. For women, it is very much cultural. For women, it's designed to be cultural, because here's why there's such a big difference and why it's so biological for men, psychological for women. An attractive female partner is the same in all eras, in all cultures, in all times. It's young and it's healthy. If a woman is young and she's healthy and she's fertile, then she's a good sexual partner. And you can figure that out in a blink. You know, it just takes one look. It's very visual. You look at a woman and you can tell if she's young, you can tell if she's healthy, you can tell usually if she's fertile. And the men's brains are designed to just lock in on that and not change, and that makes a lot of sense. You know, if what makes up a attractive sexual partner is so narrow, then you should have a sexual brain designed to lock in on that and not have a lot of change. But for women, what makes a man a good sexual partner? Well, he should be a good provider. He should have high social status so he can protect you and provide you and get you resources. He should be kind to you, and she should be kind to the kids. You know what? A husband is going to beat the kids. And these things are very culturally variable. You can't just look at a guy and know any of these things. You need to spend time with him. You need to get to know him. You need to know the cultural values. You know, a doctor in one society might be high status, but in another society, a doctor may be, you know, an outcast or you know, low status. These things are only known relative to the community, and things might change over time in a culture. You know, a man, you know, what at one time in a particular culture, you know, might have considered to be an attractive male might change, you know, in a short span of time. So women's brains are designed to be both very flexible and adaptive to the cultural situations, and also designed to really try to get a read on a man's mind. And that's why it doesn't make any sense for women to have a fixed biological reaction to men. It should take into account more cultural and social things. And that's certainly what did in women's erotica.
What are your thoughts on psychological effects of long-term porn use? Are you familiar with the study from the site Your Brain on Porn?
So we've looked at some of that research. So we haven't done any. Let me say we haven't done any research on this ourselves. So all that we know is from reading you know, other peer-reviewed articles on it, and from talking to we talk to a lot of sex therapists. You know, as part of when we go out and talk about our work, so our knowledge of it is secondhand, but it's hard to say that there's any evidence that porn is any more or less prone to provoking addiction than any other pleasurable activity, like playing video games or you know, reading science fiction books or going out to parties and drinking or any other activity. That there doesn't seem to be anything special about porn. And you know, a lot of, there's definitely critics who say that there's something special about porn that makes men more likely to get hooked and then to lose sexual interest in sexual activities outside of porn. But I've never seen any clear evidence of that. And certainly, if you talk to sex therapists who work with, you know, people with different sexual problems, they don't see this either. There are definitely porn addicts for certain. There are people that are addicted to porn, but there's people addicted to just about everything. And the amount of people that are addicted to porn seems to be a really tiny subset. And certainly too, when we look at when you look at search histories like we did, so you can see how often people are looking at porn. It's very rare to find a guy that's just looking at porn, you know, all day long, every day. Extremely rare to find what is clearly some kind of addictive behavior. You know, some people define the addiction by the idea that you're only an addict if you want to stop and you can't stop. I don't know if that's a great definition. I just, you know, I'd put it more on the frequency and a sense of compulsion about it. But you can call me in the camp that says I'm skeptical of the idea that there's something special about porn that makes men especially likely to become addicted to it.
How can your data be used to help the adult industry improve their products?
Well, I'm actually helping a website right now, as a matter of fact, using our data. So I'm actually doing this in a very direct way. There's a website called Oh Actually, which is going to be erotica for women by a really smart young woman and a couple other smart young women are putting this together. And, you know, I'm providing them the data. They you know, asked me to help them think about, you know, based on the women's patterns of online activity, what they can do. So I think it can play a big role. I mean, you know, the more you know what people actually like rather than guessing what they like. You know, for years, porn was just, the porn industry was just putting out stuff based on what the producers like themselves, you know, what they're guessing. And it's kind of funny. I remember doing a couple interviews with some porn producers, and they would tell me they were convinced that such and such kind of porn was, you know, really popular and you know, really catching on. And, like, the data just didn't show it. Like, I remember there was one guy that was sure, for example, that anal gaping, so this is where women are showing, you know, spreading themselves so you can see, you know, inside, that this was a very popular pornography. And, you know, our data showed it wasn't at all. You know, it was out there, but it wasn't even in the top 75, top 100 interests. So, so clearly that this was somebody who was driven more by his own, I think, his own personal interest in imagining that other people shared it than by any knowledge of the market. So certainly I'd say if you wanted to put together a popular porn site or very popular erotica or something like that, certainly our book is going to help you.
Do you think there needs to be more government regulation of porn?
I think it would be good for everybody. I think it would be good for everybody. I kind of think of the Colorado marijuana industry as an example of this. It's like, you know, if the government's a little more involved, then we can all breathe a sigh of relief, you know, in knowing that the porn that we're looking at is not exploitative in any way. You know, I talk to people in the porn industry, they hate this idea, understandably so, but I just feel like, you know, if a porn site had some kind of government stamp of approval, hey, like, the government checked out, their credentials are all intact, and, you know, some kind of oversight like that. Now, I'm not saying they should censor anything. I'm not saying that they should change what's up there, just that they make sure all the material is, you know, all the models are above age, that also that they've got copyrights for everything. I think that would help everyone too. And that, you know, everything's legitimate and above board. So definitely not saying that they should censor anything or change the content, just make sure the content's all legitimate. And I just think we'd all benefit from that.
So before I ask you a different question, I would like to ask you about your appearance on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. But before we get to that, is there anything else about the book that I didn't touch upon?
Yeah, I guess one, probably the thing that excites us the most in the book is a new way of understanding sexual interest. So there's two main explanations for our sexual interests in the science of sex. And one kind of explanation is what is called biological explanations or evolutionary explanations. So a biological explanation, an evolutionary explanation of why men like breasts would go, well, men like breasts because breast size is associated with estrogen levels, and estrogen levels are correlated with a woman's fertility and health. And therefore, by looking at a woman's breasts, a man can know something about her health and fertility. And that's why men have evolved to be attracted to breasts, especially large breasts. The other side is cultural explanations, or social-cultural explanations, or social constructionist explanations. And these kinds of explanations say that we develop sexual interests because of our environments and because of culture and because of social messages. So a social-cultural explanation of men's attraction to breasts would say, well, men are shown women's breasts in movies and in TVs and magazines, and large breasts are always displayed as attractive, appealing in the media, and therefore that's why men like breasts. If the media would just start showing small breasts, then men would lose their interest in breasts. So that's the social culture explanation. But in our book, we propose a third category of explanation, which we call erotical illusions. And this explanation comes out of our background in computational neuroscience. So one thing we study is optical illusions, and it's how the brain puts together different perceptions to create optical illusions. We think something like that happens in the brain with sexual content. And a good example of this is the popularity of shemale. So shemale porn is very popular among straight men, and this was a huge surprise, just the level of popularity. And this doesn't fit either evolutionary explanations or cultural explanations, because it doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary point of view what men would be attracted to, men, women's bodies with a penis. And cultural explanations can't explain it either, because this is not something that the media and society is telling straight men that they should be attracted to. And yet, there it is. It's extremely popular in every country in the world. Where does this come from? So we think it's actually what we call an erotic illusion. We think it's a trick of the brain, because if you look at this pornography, it almost always features, especially in the animated form where artists have complete control over it, it's very voluptuous female bodies. It's their feminine aspects are exactly what you find in the most popular pornography: large breasts, very rounded hips, young-looking face. And then they almost always have very large penises, too. So it seems to be a juxtaposition of these two sexual cues of attractive young female body. And I talked about how the penis is a cue for men, too. And you put those together, and it seems to just have, like, it acts like a super stimulus on the male brain. It's something that, we weren't really designed, men's brains weren't really designed to see, but when you show it, it just has this really strange effect. So we think a lot of different kinds of pornography that have been kind of mystifying why they're so popular, they fall into this category of erotic illusions. It's really just different kinds of sexual cues overlapping or put together. So on the female side, one example we use is from the Twilight series of romance, paranormal romance novels, is Edward Cullen the vampire. So why in the world is this vampire so sexually arousing for women? Well, he combines a whole lot of cues in this kind of impossible fashion. He's got a very young body, the body of a teenage boy, a hot teenage boy, but he has an adult mind because he's actually, 100 years old or however old he is. So it's a sophisticated, mature, experienced male mind in a sexy young body. He's super status. He's a super alpha male because, he can protect the girl from both human bullies and supernatural bullies, too. And a whole bunch of other cues, too. So that's the other thing in our book that I guess we're most proud of and seems to be catching on to. Other people are using this as a way of thinking about different sexual interests.
So before I wrap up the show, I guess I want to point out you were a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So how did you use your research on an analysis of the human brain? How did that help you? So basically you didn't win the million, but well technically you did because you got the question, but you won $500,000 on that show.
That's right. Yeah, I figured out the $1 million question, but I didn't have the guts to pull the trigger and go for it. So at the time I was still in graduate school and I was studying memory. And so, reading a lot of research on memory and thinking about memory. And I just remember thinking, what could I, how could I use this, profitably? And I was like, I bet I could win money in the game show. And then I just suddenly thinking, well, what? Maybe I could use this to win money on Millionaire, because it just seemed like a perfect opportunity to just apply these different memory techniques I was learning about in my research. And so, that's what I did. I just, memorized a large quantity of information, and really what the hard part is figuring out how to recall it, a system to recall, a vast quantity of memory memories that you've and facts that you've learned in a short amount of time. So yeah, that's what I did. It worked really well, and I used the system to figure out the $1 million question, and I should have trusted the system, but one thing I unfortunately did not prepare for was the emotional intensity of actually being in that situation, suddenly having to ponder the risk of losing $500,000 versus going for $1 million, and I just wasn't prepared for the intensity of the moment. If I had prepared, I think I would have just gone ahead and gone for it, and I would have got the $1 million.
This has been an excellent show. I would like to thank Ogie Ogost for being on. Check out his book, A Billion Wicked Thoughts.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun. You asked really good questions.